I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. Now, most of us, when we set up home, think about the length of curtains and carpets and whether we'll have to repaint the living room to match the color of the couch. Most of us don't think about things like the risk of rocket-propelled grenades and carjacking and whether it's smarter to leave the flak jacket by the front door or right beside the bed. These will be the sorts of questions asked and answered by Anne Bernard and Thanasi Kambanis as they head to Baghdad to set up home together. They are both correspondents with the Boston Globe. They've decided that rather than dash from Beantown to Baghdad every few months, they'd prefer to live in the Iraqi capital for the next year to cover this crucial story. They're here to talk with us and answer your questions about their year ahead. We'd like to hear your input, your experience, and your advice. What stories do you want to hear from them when they're in Baghdad? Are you still interested in the ongoing conflict and the efforts to build democracy? And what would you like to know about the lives of reporters who cover the story? Our number is 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm joined in my studio here by the Boston Globe reporters Anne Bernard and Thanasi Kambanis. They've been covering the war since last March and just planning on heading out again. Nice to have you both here.
Good to be here, Dick.
When do you leave?
Well, we head out on Sunday night, and we should be in Baghdad by Tuesday or Wednesday.
Which way are you going in? Through Amman?
Through Amman, driving.
So the excitement begins actually the moment you leave Amman. What's the latest on the highway going into Baghdad? What do you hear?
Well, there's been security reports of attacks on some cars, and I think the risk is always bandits attacking the cars as well as getting caught up in a military convoy that could get attacked while you're next to it.
Funny, and that going into Baghdad along that same road that you traveled last April is less safe today than it was when you did it during the war.
That's right. At the time, it seemed like the safest way to go in because there had been less military activity out west. Now, the highway in from Jordan is one of the most frequently attacked areas.
Can we talk about what's on the news, on the radio news today? Because I was thinking of you guys when I was listening to the radio news. I mean, I think about it in terms of the people there. But the latest news from this string of bomb attacks in Karbala and Baghdad is 85 people killed in Karbala, some 56 people in Baghdad. And when you turned on the radio this morning and heard this, what was the first thing going through your head?
Well, I think ever since April, reporters have been wondering when and if a civil war would begin and how bad the Iraqi-on-Iraqi attacks would get. And something like this, where Shiite Muslims are attacked on one of the holiest days in their calendar, and they react by accusing everyone from Sunni Muslims to Americans to Al-Qaeda, that certainly raises fears that this could be the beginning of something larger.
Also, for me, it brought back memories of last, was it April, when I went to Muharram, which was the first Shiite pilgrimage post-Saddam, and similar to the numbers today, there were millions on the streets, and then it was just an exuberant, unrestrained demonstration of just mass euphoria and joy, and it was a beautiful thing to see, and that was a hopeful moment where one could look at these masses of Shiites and think perhaps with freedom of expression, these people are going to turn not to religious fanaticism and not to political extremism, but towards a sort of new and vibrant, happy medium. And to see, less than a year later, a similar celebration turning to fear and this much death alarms me and also makes me very sad.
I want to listen just with the two of you to something that Steve Inskeep was saying on Morning Edition this morning, because he's in Baghdad and was covering these latest bomb attacks and was talking about how Iraqis are responding to that in terms of turning their attention not just on each other but on Americans as well.
As we spoke to people in the crowd, some people were blaming Wahhabis, Sunni Muslims, some people were blaming Ba'athists, but many people were very angry at America, blaming the United States, some of them saying it was the Americans' responsibility simply because the Americans have occupied this country, others blaming Americans directly, applying different conspiracy theories. Police were telling us that Western journalists and even Arab journalists have been attacked around the shrine today, and we were actually confronted by an angry group of people who knew that we were Americans and were shouting, "Go away, go home," some of them in a threatening way and others because they were concerned for our safety.
And there was also the report, I understand, of an Italian photographer in Karbala who was beaten up, just sort of caught up in the frenzy of the crowd. Are there Are the stories and things like that that you hear, Anne, moments where you go, oh, do we really want to be doing this?
Well, absolutely. We still want to be covering the story, but even since I was last there through January, I think the list of places that you want to be wary about going to has grown dramatically. Police stations, entrances to coalition facilities, any place where there's a large gathering of Iraqis, say a political party or a religious celebration. But this covers two-thirds of the things that we would want to be covering as reporters. So it's a big dilemma.
How do you resolve that?
Well, I'm hesitant to speak too frankly, knowing that my mother's somewhere listening to this program. But, I mean, we've talked about this a lot before making the decision to go, and I think you just have to weigh what's a story worth, and if you think a story is too dangerous to cover, you just don't go.
But, I mean, it's true. One of the hardest things is not actually assessing the danger based on what Thanasi, you and Anne are going to have to decide on a Monday morning or on a Tuesday morning 2 months from now. But you're very conscious of what mothers and brothers and sisters and friends are hearing and thinking of you as well. That's something that you carry with you when you go on a story like this.
Well, someone said that we have the easiest job of all because we're going on this great adventure, and it's the people who are back here reading the news and wondering how it's affecting us who really have the difficult job.
Also, one thing we tell friends and relatives is that when you are watching the news from afar, you envision all of Baghdad being engulfed in a conflagration all the time. And of course, when you're living there, you're driving around the streets, you're seeing the huge stacks of electronics for sale, you're seeing people going to school, coming home from work, you are coming home to your hotel room after a tiring day and taking a nice hot shower. So to you, it's similar to people who hear the news about New York City and think that every time you walk around there, you're going to be attacked. So obviously Baghdad's a little more dangerous than New York City, but I try to tell people that when they're worried about me.
And that there's a lot of people living there who are making it their home.
That's right. That's right.
Okay, now there's a little bit of a love story behind this decision to go off to Baghdad together. I need the PG version of that. We're family radio here. Where did you guys meet each other? Was it at the Globe? Who starts?
Well, Thanasi's pointing to me.
That's all right. I'll put him on the spot in a minute.
We knew each other somewhat at the Globe, but we didn't spend much time working in the same office, and we didn't know each other that well.
Especially when you're in the field and always in different places, right?
That's right.
In Framingham. She was in Boston.
Well, there you go.
When we were getting ready to go to the war, we would bump into each other at the power bar rack at Trader Joe's, stocking up for the camping out that we expected to do while covering the war. We obviously sympathized with each other about the situation we were going into. When we found ourselves in Iraq together, we had to work together in a more intense way than you ever do have to. I was trying to think about an anecdote to tell about this, and I hope my editors won't be too upset to hear that at one point the wind knocked my satellite phone off the balcony in Baghdad, and it was after curfew when technically you could get shot if you went outside in the dark. And somehow I decided that it would be helpful if Thanasi came down with me to look for the phone at 2 a.m. And when he agreed to come down, I knew that he was a really great guy.
Worth spending some time with. The decision to work together in Baghdad, Thanasi. That, I mean, when you're together as a couple as correspondents, that's one thing. But then to be reporting together as correspondents kind of adds a new level of considering. Okay, how's this going to work, right?
Well, I mean, I think that's going to be the real great adventure of the coming year is charting that, but. I went back to Iraq in August and September by myself, and that's when I decided I would love to cover this story, but I had no interest in covering it alone. I came back and I said, if we could find a way to move to Iraq together, the two of us, that would be a dream come true for me. This is the kind of story I've wanted to cover my whole life, but I did not see any appeal in, spending 12 solitary workaholic months, having the story all to myself.
If you move there, though, as a pair of correspondents and as a couple, how do you separate your own personal life, whatever is, time that you want to have together from the story. Don't you end up being consumed by it, Anne?
Well, it can be consuming, absolutely. But I think, unlike the times when we went for 6 weeks and just sprinted,
right,
going there for a year, we know that this is our life. This is not a special occasion, and this is not a time to exhaust ourselves. This is a time to pace ourselves. So we've spent a lot of time, actually, in the last few weeks thinking about how we're going to live a balanced life and doing concrete things like downloading a lot of CDs and buying DVDs to watch in case we're shut in and can't go out for dinner anymore. Just trying to think about how we can have some time for ourselves to cook, to be together in a non-reporter type way.
I want to talk a little bit more about that later on the program, but just before we're heading into our break, and I wanted to hear a little bit from both of you about whether or not going to live in a place like that and doing it together is going to allow you to tell some different stories, stories that are harder to do when you're, as you're saying, Anne, doing the kind of sprinting in and out.
Well, I mean, to some extent, that goes without saying that if you stay there for a long time, you have a chance to develop a deeper understanding and work better on stories. I don't know if you're getting it, what I think you might be getting at, which is that by being there and having some sort of personal life and sense of sort of, you know, I haven't left my life behind to go cover the story. My life is with me right here, and that means I'm going to approach the story perhaps, you know, more as a human being, perhaps more from a position of empathy or patience than I would if I were thinking, you know.
Well, you might get to meet a neighbor. I mean, that's one of the, you know.
I'd like to add that one of the first things I did as a reporter after college was go to Russia and work at the Moscow Times in the early 90s when that society was going through a dramatic and sometimes violent transformation. And the fact that I lived there and considered it my home and had my social life there and a lot of the adventures of my early 20s there certainly made me feel that I was in a real place and not the story wasn't out there removed from me.
There's a little bit more nuance in the reporting when you get to revisit the same person or the same place or the same ideas at a more measured pace, Thanasi?
Yeah, I mean, there was a little preview of that in going back three times over the last year and being able to see, you know, there was a couple of families that I checked in with every time and a couple of places I went and I could sort of measure the transition. But I think that by living there, you also develop, you have a stake in the place yourself. And you also have a stake in not representing it two-dimensionally and sort of boiling it down to, you know, crazy religious factions or, you know, society on the brink of war. You end up being vested in making it real and three-dimensional for the readers back home.
All right, Connection listeners, these are the people who will be writing the stories that you will be reading in the Boston Globe and online if you're not in the Boston area. And so I'm interested in hearing from you. Our number's 1-800-423-8255. What sort of stories would you have, Thanasi and Anne, working on once they move to Baghdad and get to dig in on this story in a way that the traveling correspondent might not be able to do? 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR. I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. Well, I bet it's been a while since you contemplated a move to a place as dramatic as Baghdad. Thanasi Kambanis and Anne Bernard are doing just that, going there as a couple, as a pair of foreign correspondents who will be reporting from there for the Boston Globe. We're joined on the line now by Shelley Thackrell. She's been with the BBC for 7 years, and when I last met Shelley, she was running the whole BBC operation in Baghdad. Shelley, nice of you to join us on the phone.
Thank you, Dick. Thanks for asking me.
You had been or have been in Baghdad for what now, some 10 months on and off?
On and off, yes. I don't have quite the same romance as Vanessa and Anne, but I do have a big love affair with the country. It's a great country.
So you were listening in a little bit earlier. That love affair that you're describing, Shelley, is something which you know, is not going to come across necessarily in a story that Barbara Plett's filing from Karbala today about the number of bodies killed in the bombings. Is it when you get a chance to spend the time in the country, such as you did, that you get a little bit closer to the people and to an understanding of what's going on beyond the bombs?
Absolutely. It's getting to know the people and just, you know, how special the people. I mean, they've been through a lot, and it's one of the things that you're inspired by these people is just how tough they are. I mean, they are very proud people. They work really hard. They're conscientious, and they don't give up. I mean, they're really resilient, and they are very positive about what will come out of all of this, whether it will take 6 months, whether it will take 12 months. But for the most part, they are they're pretty impressive people to be around, and I think that gives a lot of us strength as well.
I was thinking of you a few minutes ago when Anne was describing the way that we make these mistakes by assuming that whatever's going on in a country is what we see on the little black box on the television screen. I can imagine in the months that you spent there a number of times having to just say to a friend, you know, it's not really as bad as it might appear.
That's true. I mean, one of the most common questions you get asked is, what's it like? What do you do? What do you eat? And I do television and radio, and one of the things that's probably maybe a pitfall of television is that you have to get it in 1 minute 30, and it's just images that, like Anne was saying, you know, you're putting an aftermath of a bomb blast, you know, hospital victims, and that doesn't exactly explain to the viewer back home or the listener in another part of the world about just what it's like, about the fact that people do have satellite television. They, you know, they do go out, they do go and eat food. Their lives are pretty much normal.
And when you're living there, Shelley, do you ever get a chance to leave the story, to go out into the garden of that house that the BBC has and put your feet up, or even to walk by the Tigris and relax a little bit?
No.
I was afraid you were going to say that.
But, you know, that's a personal choice. I just, because we're all, I don't know how to explain it. It's almost like a Big Brother house. I don't know. I don't mean to, it sounds such a cliche, but you work with pretty amazing people. We're all in it. We're all doing the same job. And you know, there isn't very much downtime, but that doesn't mean that, you know, you suffer as a result. I mean, you make pretty strong relationships. You bond really well. I mean, we cook dinners together. We eat. We talk about other things. But there isn't anything, you know, apart where, I suppose, when the weather starts to improve, we'll go and, you know, sit by the pool. But, you know, even that doesn't happen very often.
And there's something else, too, about a place like that, Shelley. And maybe Anne and Danassi want to join me in on this. And that is that when you're in a place like Baghdad, well, I mean, I'll speak personally here. You and the BBC crew had me and my producer over for dinner, and it was one of those sort of moments when, you know, we get to hang around with other people doing the same thing. In fact, you get a lot closer to people in a place like that when you get those little windows of relaxation, don't you?
Absolutely, and there's, you know, there's a real understanding. I've never done a war before, but, for, you know, for most people, you know, I work with really experienced people who everybody brings to the table, you know, another story, another bit of advice. Some, you know, don't worry about this, it's going to be okay, or, you know, we really shouldn't be doing that. And you know, and it's good to talk about it. And maybe you can't have those conversations when you leave the country and you're talking to people who have no idea what it's like. Mm. But for the most part, I mean, I think we're extraordinarily lucky to have, you know, very strong people around us, and people that like Anne and Thanasis, they want to go out and cover the story, and they know that it's a difficult story to do because you have to make it more interesting. You know, you have to basically keep generating that interest and keep sort of motivating people, editors back, whether it's back in the US or back in London. You know, we have got to cover this. You know, we've got to keep at this because we've invested so much time and energy in it.
Okay. Can I jump in on that?
Yeah, sure.
I think Shelley's raising the most important point, which is, I think, what we've spent the most time thinking about before we go. We're moving to Baghdad at a time when interest here in the story is waning. And the Globe has made this commitment to send 2 reporters, but we're trying to figure out how to write about this story that 11 months after the war, Americans don't want three stories a day about. And I know with the British audience for BBC, it might be a little bit different, but the considerations are basically the same. How do you, what story can you tell about Iraqis, about Americans in Iraq, about the new political order taking shape there that is going to draw people in? And I hope your listeners can give us some clues to that too.
And it is. It's about, you know, those counterintuitive questions about saying, oh, I didn't realize that happened. I didn't realize that, you know, they drank Pepsi or they, you know, that they, oh, I can identify with that life. And I think we have to just, as much as we do the carnage and the destruction and what's going wrong, we need to do more positive stories as well.
Now, Shelley, 5 days before these suitcases get sealed, any tips of something that Thanasi and Anne should stuff in at the last minute?
No, I think they'll be fine. I think they'll have an amazing time. I mean, they have no expectations about what it's going to be like, and it's part adventure, and it's, you know, it's just part an amazing, amazing experience.
Shelley, so nice of you to join us on the program today.
Thank you.
Shelley Thackrell, BBC producer, who has been living in Baghdad on and off for just about the last 10 months. Now, our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. Let's bring it back to you, Connection listeners, your interests in what you want from journalists, particularly two of them here who are moving to Baghdad and thinking very hard about the sort of stories that they're going to be writing as they travel to the extent that they can around that country. Let's go first to Ashland, Massachusetts. Imran's on the line. Imran, thanks for calling.
Hi. You know, I was going to say that I think one thing that I would like to see from journalists who do go over there is perhaps kind of spending more time on trying to dispel some of the myths and stereotypes about Arabs and Muslims. And I think that, you know, the past 2 years, you've seen a lot of stories about, you know, Muslim rage and all you get the impression that, you know, Arabs are just a bunch of angry people.
Mm-hmm.
And so one of the things I've appreciated about your series was when you were in Baghdad was like interviewing people from an orchestra. And I just think that it shows more of a dimension of life in another part of the world that I think most Americans just will never see. And I think that's very important.
And it's finding, as Imran says, those ordinary stories and telling them in a way that makes them interesting or extraordinary enough to make the front page or page A3, you know?
Absolutely. You know, I think some of my favorite stories that I've done over there have been more about small aspects of daily life. And even when you're covering a political story, to find individuals who are experiencing that in some kind of nuanced way. You know, I covered in Ramadi and Fallujah, particularly in Ramadi and the western part of Iraq, meetings of people that were wrangling with American officials over how to create democracy in their region. And sure, they were angry. I don't think we want to dispel, we don't want to ignore people's anger when they're legitimately angry about things. But people also had an incredibly nuanced view. And they wanted to, people don't think about the fact that in Ramadi there are 200 lawyers who attend a caucus and demand more from the American officials by saying, we don't just want to be appointed by you. We want to have a real election here. You know, I spent a lot of time in April with people who run hospitals who had spent the entire war guarding, doctors who had spent the entire war guarding their hospitals with rifles. And they were not about politics. They were about how can we do our jobs and how can I make sure the doctors who work for me are sane and that their families are okay and that my patients are not afraid to come out and come to the hospital.
Let me just go back to Imran for half a second here. Imran, when you listen to Anne's sense of what the story is and can be, is there a part of you that thinks, wow, we're at a moment here. We're at a moment where the American public is either going to go stampeding off in search of the presidential election story and completely forget about Iraq, or that there's a moment here to take high-quality reporting and keep people focused on, you know, what's common between the two countries rather than what separates them?
Well, I guess my sense is that with the upcoming elections, that's probably going to take the majority of bandwidth there, but I think I would like to see, you know, these interesting stories that are there. I mean, you know, in our own paper in the Boston Globe, you have a whole lifestyle section devoted to things that go on in this country, and how cool would it be to see maybe a lifestyle section about things that go on in another part of the world, especially a country like Baghdad, which has such a rich history, but I think most people don't even know, you know, what there is to offer over there.
Well, Imran, I really appreciate your sentiment, and I hope my editors are listening, because one of the opportunity costs of what we do is chasing daily news stories at the expense of a lot of these stories. So, I mean, for example, I remember wanting to do a story about the Iraqi boxing team and having to give that up to do a story about the emergence of a new Shiite militia. And, you know, half a dozen stories that I think are exactly the kinds of stories you're saying you want to see more of fall by the wayside, you know, whether it's beauty salons or the wedding industry or, you know, people's pets, which, you know, frankly, probably you would care more about than the latest twist and turn of the Iraqi Governing Council's constitutional negotiations.
Will you guys have the chance to do that? Can you say to a foreign editor at the Globe, can you say, you know what, take that, you know, latest bomb at the latest police station off the wires, right? Run the AP story, because I'm working on this fabulous feature about whether or not it's Thanasi or, you know, weddings or that sort of thing. It's hard to do. I know that.
Well, yes. I mean, I think especially with two of us there now, we'll have more opportunities to do that because we'll be able to coordinate. Also, being there for a longer period of time, we'll have more authority in saying, horrible as it sounds, which bombing it actually takes us to a new level and which bombing is something that is horrible, but, you know, is going to sound just like the last story about a bombing. And I think the longer we're there and the more we can sort of understand those nuances, we'll be able to say, listen, I think it's okay to let the wires take this one, and I'm going to go write about I think one of the most fun stories we've had in the paper about Iraq was Ellen Berry's story about dressmakers in Najaf. You know, things that just let you into life.
You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. Our number is 1-800-423-8255. Next to Needham, Massachusetts, Sally's on the line. Sally, thanks for calling.
Dick, thank you. In listening to your two guests and their point about specifically about keeping readers interested in what's going on in Iraq,
yeah,
it made me think of a book I read a long time ago called Common Ground by Anthony Lucas, which was about it tracked four different families through the Boston desegregation turmoil in the 70s.
Right.
And it was fascinating watching different economic families and different economic backgrounds, different degrees of power or influence as they struggled through desegregation. And it would be fascinating to see how different levels in Iraq make their way through this next year of such drastic change.
Just before I turn to Thanasi and Anne on this one, though, Sally, tell me as a reader, as someone who watches or listens or reads the news, whether or not you'd have a greater appetite for a, you know, 3,000 or 4,000 word feature in a weekend magazine along the lines of what you've just described, rather than the sort of rat tat tat of the front page headlines.
Oh, no question. I would much rather read a more lengthy discussion. You can pull the rat-tat-tat off, you know, the AP or off the Internet anytime. You know, that's all we get is the rat-tat-tat. What the beauty, I think, of what your guests could be doing being there for an hour is really sink their teeth into something that a story that's going to illustrate all aspects of life by through the example of people living it, and to be able to follow some how they deal with this over the next year would be, I think, so illustrative of the life over there. It would be fascinating.
Sally, you're not alone in feeling that way. And the story I've written in the last year that elicited the most response by far was about a family, the Hamid family in Sadr City. I wrote about them three times, and I did not write about their politics. I wrote about how they were coping with the death of three of the children in the family, the economic need as he lost his job at a foundry, and various relatives moved in. And the last story I wrote about them in September, I mentioned that his brother could not afford a prosthetic leg, I got about 50 emails from people in Massachusetts offering to send $250 to buy him a new leg. And the real illuminating thing about that was that all these people read that story and empathized immediately with that family. And no other story I've written has come anywhere close to drawing that kind of response.
So, Anne, when you seal up that suitcase, are you going to put an abaya in there? Are you going to have to spend the next year with a scarf on? I mean, it will be an issue in some places that you go, not in others. How do you make that decision?
Well, it depends on what part of the country you're in and what kinds of people you're going to see. Baghdad is still a pretty secular place as far as how people dress. But I am finding more and more that I like to wear a scarf on my head when I go out, mainly so that I'm not as quickly identifiable as a foreigner from a distance. It just makes me more comfortable that I don't draw attention to myself and I can be more of an observer. In other places, you absolutely have to wear an abaya, which is a long flowing garment that women wear that covers everything.
And the abaya is the garment, the headscarf is okay.
Yeah, and there are some people that won't meet with you if you're not wearing one because they feel it's improper. So you just have to have one with you all the time in case you have to throw it on.
Our number is 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. Thanasi Kambanis and Anne Bernard are leaving on Sunday for a year in Baghdad. From that place, they will be filing stories for the Boston Globe, available on the website of the Boston Globe, if you're not having that paper available where you're listening to this program. But in a broader sense, Connection listeners, some thoughts from you on what it is that you'd like to have people bring you from that country, the journalism that you think is missing, or what a reporter who's actually living there can do that the sort of commando reporters who dash in and dash out are not able to get at. 1-800-423-8255. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR. Dick Gordon, you're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. I have two guests in the studio with me. Thanasi Kambanis was in Baghdad the day after it fell, working as a reporter for the Boston Globe. And Anne Bernard was at that point, I think, in Doha, Qatar, feeling very frustrated that her story sucked. But by the time she finally caught up with Thanasi in Baghdad, the two of them had a chance to work together on what is arguably one of the most interesting and exciting stories of our time. They've decided to take advantage of that, move to Baghdad, file full-time on that story for the next year, and they're here in the studio to talk to me and to you about issues and questions and ideas that you have. 1-800-423-8255. Next to Aiken, South Carolina, Debbie's with us on the line. Debbie, thanks for calling.
Yes, thank you.
So, what do you want?
Okay, what I'd really like to hear is stories about how our American soldiers are actually interacting with the normal, everyday person in Iraq. A lot of us have sons and daughters over there, and we hear a lot about how they, are getting the terrorists and all that kind of stuff, but which is all well and good. But it would really be nice to hear that they have normal life over there, too, you know, and how they interact with or if they even have any interaction with, you know, just regular, everyday experiences, you know, with the Iraqi people.
You know, and Debbie, it's a great question because, and it, in many ways, the story over there is one of two solitudes. And there's not a lot of interaction, is there? I mean, you were there more recently than I was.
It really depends on the part of the country, again. But I think you're touching on something really important, Debbie, because I spent a lot of time with both soldiers and civilian U.S. officials out in the western part of Iraq in January, and there was a great dedication on the part of a lot of those individuals to really get to know Iraqis and make a difference in their lives and to make this occupation turn out to bring benefits to Iraqis. But they were so constrained by the security fears in that part of the country that they would roll into town in a convoy to talk about democracy and roll out an hour later. And, you know, in the Arab world, personal interaction is very important as far as getting things done and winning trust. And to parachute in for an hour and talk to people and leave just doesn't fly. You know, soldiers down in the south had experiences where they had great interactions with locals, but then there were these strange bureaucratic miscues in the U.S. operation where the soldiers knew that the people wanted a soccer field funding for a soccer league, and the edict came down from the U.S. officials in Baghdad to build them an expensive basketball court, and they didn't know how to play basketball. So, you know, it's just soldiers are very well-meaning. They are getting a lot done in some cases, with less money and less authority to make decisions than they would like to have.
Well, and this is a human story that's related but removed from the political story, which is how these soldiers are living in Iraq. And in places where I stayed, like Samarra, there is a lot of interaction, and the real ambassadors of the American presence there are these privates and majors and lieutenants who stay in a town for 3 or 4 months. And these guys have a wonderful way, some of them. They get out of their tanks and they walk around at great personal risk to themselves. And there was one man from North Carolina, from Asheville, who carried an Arabic dictionary with him. And by the time I met him in December, he had learned about 1,000 words, and he would stop and try and converse with the shopkeepers. And he felt like by showing the people he met that he was likable, that he could sort of person by person make Iraqis realize that not all Americans were evil and out to get them.
Does it work? Do you find people ready to respond to that kind of gesture of humanity?
It's hard to know what it really means, but yeah, it's just like when you walk into someone's house and you speak to them in Arabic, when you're a soldier coming in to pay for damages or tell them that you're here making a show of force, and these guys who go the extra mile to say, I've tried to learn something about your culture, they are, you know, they're invited to sit down and have tea, and you end up with these bizarre scenes where you have 5 guys sitting cross-legged in a tiny living room, balancing their rifles on their knees, holding these tiny cups of tea, speaking mangled Arabic to someone who doesn't understand a word they're saying. But that does seem to work on some level.
1-800-423-8255. Next to Cambridge, Massachusetts, Tracy's on the line. Tracy, thanks for calling.
Hi, thank you. I have two sets of questions. One is, what do Iraqi towns look like? What level of development are they? Could you give people a sense of, do they look like sort of like Istanbul or Mexico City, or more or less technologically, what are the buildings made out of? Give people a sense of the actual flavor of the streets. And the other question I have is, do we know how many Iraqi war dead there are, both civilian and military?
Okay, on your first question, this is the kind of thing that I want to make an effort to get more into my stories. And it's a great question. I wish it looked like Istanbul. Baghdad is a largely concrete block city. There's only a very small downtown area that has the feel of a traditional Arab souk. Very small area, a few old, beautiful Islamic buildings, but mostly sort of Soviet-looking concrete blocks. Some of the smaller towns are mostly sandstone or mud brick houses, very nondescript, sort of square, boxy houses with small shops with corrugated metal doors that open on a main street. Most of the color comes from the goods that are hanging in the stores, plastic soccer balls, women's robes, things like that. I was in a beautiful city in the west called Haditha that has the Euphrates River flowing through it and old water wheels that are 100 years old and beautiful houses under palm tree groves. But most places aren't quite that beautiful. On your second question, I think there have been tallies made by think tanks that estimated the number of soldiers dead. I can't can't think of the number right now, but the and then there's another.
I don't know them either, Tracy. I'm sorry. I think that you can get close to some of the estimates by checking websites like Human Rights Watch and Amnesty International. I know that they've been doing some work with estimates.
The number of Iraqi civilian dead is a huge political issue. No one has that number, and I don't think anyone's even made any solid claims on that, and that's partly because the U.S. doesn't want doesn't want something out there for the Iraqi public to then react to.
But the number, I mean, boy, when you're there, is anything from, you know, 5 to 50,000, depending on who you happen to stop and talk to on the street. 1-800-423-8255. Next to Greensboro, North Carolina, and Jahan's on the line. Jahan, thanks for calling.
Oh, thanks for taking my call, Dick. I'm interested in the stories that get filed but don't get picked up, meaning as an American reading newspapers and watching television and listening to the radio, I seem to get a very, very consistent and very narrow sort of range of commentary, whereas when I read online newspapers from other countries, I get very different reporting. I'm interested in the comments of your guests on the pressure they feel to report within a mainstream of reporting for American audiences. And what
do you mean, Jahan? Let me interrupt you for half a second here. When you say within a mainstream of reporting, do you mean seeing that under the sort of the way that the war is interpreted or talked about in political terms in this country? You know, that the war is a good thing or the war is a bad thing or the war is going well or the war is going badly. Is that what you mean?
In part, but not really that sort of mechanical. I mean, is there a pressure from what amounts to editors and publishers to provide material for a given audience that's very different for overseas consumption? It seems that whether I read the headlines from AP or Reuters in America and what I read in my newspapers is all very consistent, yet very different good stories get filed in different media overseas. And I always feel like, you know, I have to read everything from all over the world because I can't get – I'd like to know how many stories they filed just simply aren't picked up because they don't fit into the editorial mix, let's say, of the consumption.
Okay, well, we'll deal with the arithmetic and then move out on up from there.
Can I actually ask John a question? I mean, just to clarify, we never file stories that don't get printed in the Globe. I mean, what we file runs in the Globe. If you mean gets picked up by other papers, we don't really have any control over that. But I'm curious if you can tell us what sort of news stories, not opinion columns, what sort of news stories you see appearing in, say, the British press or the alternative press that aren't mentioned in the American media.
Well, in this particular case, I happen to work for Agence Globale Syndicate, so I read The Guardian, I read Yom Yiddish Shimbun, I read Corriere della Sera, papers from Italy and Britain, and you and I both know that their choices for stories filed, the tone, the tenor, the focus, the human interest stories, the military numbers reported, are radically different from what I can read in a very consistent basis on the LA Times, Chicago Tribune, New York Times, Boston Globe, Washington Post, meaning that there seems to be a tremendous homogeneity in reporting in America. And both in tone, you know, tones, article selection, and I think that's a frequent criticism. I think I'm interested in knowing the mechanics of how it works from the reporting end, and whether you really, if you agree with that, and one, if there's pressure on you, either unconsciously, subtly, and so forth. You know?
Okay, Jahan, thanks very much for your call. You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio, and compare it to your time in Moscow, your time, you know, looking at writing from somewhere. Is there an American story here and another story?
Well, I think there's a natural interest in what is the experience of American soldiers and officials there, whether they're doing a good job or a bad job.
Fair enough. There,
clearly, we have to focus on that because it's important to hold the government accountable for what's going on over there. I personally do not feel pressure to write certain kinds of stories. I think we touched on the main kind of pressure we feel is to always cover the daily and make sure that the Globe is weighing in on all the major stories, which always competes with your time for doing more off the beaten track stories. That's probably the biggest problem. We need to hit all the keys of the piano in terms of types of tone and types of style in stories. And
1-800-423-8255. Let's take a last call from Durham, North Carolina. Romy's on the phone. Romy, thanks for calling.
Hi, Dick. How are you?
Fine, thanks.
Good. Hey, I'm a high school teacher, and we were sitting in my class, and I took a break, and I heard the show on at my house. But my class is really interested in hearing about the youth in Iraq and what their life is like. because they don't really get a chance to get involved in the news much or really pay much attention to it because they get pretty bored all the time with it. And they're really, they really want to know about the youth in Iraq, and they also wanted to sort of be able to keep track of Anne and Danazi as they go out on this adventure of theirs.
Oh, are you guys going to run a web page or a blog or anything like that? Have you been thinking of something, way for Romy's high school class to keep track of you?
Well, we're thinking about putting together a website, and Romy, you should tell your class I'm from Chapel Hill, so you know, I'm a hometown boy. I think the youth story is one we've been wanting to cover since April, and it's one of those ones that keeps getting dropped off the list because of terrible news. You know, we'd be happy to keep in touch with your class directly too, if you'd like to email us and establish contact that way.
Well, let's see if we can put something together here. We can put your email addresses or links to your email addresses on the Connection website, and Romy, others who are interested in keeping tabs on you two can do it that way. It already feels like a different story, doesn't it, Anne?
Yes.
I mean, that's a good thing, isn't it, to somehow break out of the what's the story today, honey, I'm going to Tikrit, what are you going to do, to think about how people like Romy's high school class will consume what you produce.
Well, and if we're not happy with the stories we're writing, we could set up a webcam or something and do a real world, you know, homemaking in Baghdad.
That'd be more like a survivor, I suspect. Anyway, the best of luck to both of you. Godspeed. Hope things are great. I hope you have a lot of fun over there telling the story as well as the tough stuff that you're going to have. And we will be checking back in with you.
Thank you very much.
Thanks, Dick.
That's Anne Bernard and Thanasi Kambanis. Earlier, we talked with the BBC Baghdad producer, Shelley Thackrell. And just to mention, if you're interested in keeping track of these two, contact them directly through their own email, which you can find on our website. We are at www.theconnection.org. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection.